Possession number 12243, Captain De Courcy Ireland, Reel 11.
De Courcy Ireland, Reel 11. We were talking about when you visited Heligoland Island, and you said you heard you were in harbour when you heard a motorboat approaching.
We heard a motorboat approaching, so we stood to. We had sentries out, and they reported this. So we stood to, and the captain was trying to make up his mind whether he'd switch on a searchlight. When we got a hail, warship ahoy, please do not show a light. May we come alongside? We have a petition. And so we let them come alongside, lowered a Jacob's ladder, and four men climbed up, came on board, led by a very big man, in a sort of fisherman's jersey, that sort of thing. And he, rather to our surprise, I was on deck at the time, saluted when he got on the quarter deck. And he said, "I am the chief elder of Heligoland, the islanders, and these are elders of the island. May I see your captain, please? I have a petition." So we took him down below, all sat down in the captain's cabin, and he explained who he was the elder, and he had a petition which he wanted delivered to the Supreme Council of the Allies, now sitting in Versailles to decide the fate of nations. And he wanted to hand this over to us to take back, explained all this. He talked more or less perfect English, really. And then we saw the captain, Pepler, looking at him a lot, and they were looking at each other a good deal. And then Pepler, he had given his name. He said his name was Nichols. And then Peplow suddenly said to him, which actually astounded all of us, "What was your last ship, Nichols?" And he said, he looked rather like that, then he said, "Glory, sir. I was master at arms of the Glory. And I remember you now, sir. You were one of the midshipmen. 1907. So that was that. And then he told us his story. He was an islander, and he joined the Navy, British Navy, because Heligoland then belonged to Britain, and he joined the British Navy in 1887. And he served his 22 years, he then retired on pension. And of course by then Heligoland had gone back to Germany. It was sold in 1890, I think, for Zanzibar, or concessions in Zanzibar. They had governed themselves for, he said, centuries. When they crossed, then they became German, and he said that he was treated badly because he'd served in the Royal Navy, and so was his wife. Very Prussian, all the treatment and so on. Then, interesting to us, he said on the 26th of July 1914, that was 8 or 9 days before war broke out, they were all suddenly taken off the island, all the islanders, and interned. And he and his wife were put into prison. But I think later they were just put to the internees, and they were interned in the Third War. They got back after the war. I found most of the houses were either occupied by Germans or been looted. All they wanted was to get their freedom again.
So this petition was to get them away from Germany?
The petition was to get them away from Germany. Yeah, to come back. They wanted to come back. They wanted to come back, either govern themselves or come back under Britain, because I've got the... we Heligolanders in our little island in the middle of the sea, far from the world's commotion, form the very smallest nation that has for centuries retained its independence and local customs. We seek neither wealth nor ostentation, but desire only to live our lives in peace and contentment, as our forefathers did before us. And that, as I said, is addressed to the Supreme Council of the Allies, deciding the fate of nations. Took that home and forwarded it. And that was the last I ever heard of it. Anyway.
Where were you on your way to now?
We were on our way to the Baltic, I think, shortly after we got back.
Now, there's a problem now. You took over as a senior sub.
Yes.
A navigating officer, I think.
Yeah.
Could you explain the circumstances of that? Because it was because the other chap hadn't quite been keeping up to date with the chart, had he?
No.
And it became apparent through no fault of any...
I found out... I went on watch. When we were going up, we were on our way to the Baltic. And I went on watch... And I had to get out on the chart, you see. And as I got it out, I knew it. I'm afraid that I pretty well knew that he hadn't been doing his stuff.
In what way?
Hadn't been correcting all the notices to mariners. You get notices to mariners come out when it changes in buoys, lighthouses, anything like shoals, rocks found, that sort of thing. Really important ones are red notices. Those are things like minefields, so on. And getting a chart out, I pulled out a bundle of red notices, which were mostly about minefields, their position, those that hadn't been swept, and found that we were heading straight for one. So on. Well, I had to report the captain straight away, you see, we go straight into the sea. And there was a hell of a row. And
you didn't have much option, I presume, other than to tell the captain.
Oh, no, I had to tell him.
And he would know straight away who was to blame without.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah. So he got what they call logged. You know, put your name in the log, ship's log. What
as a punishment?
Wrong. Yes, what you've done wrong. You know, had occasion to log Lieutenant so and so for failure to, you know, keep his charts up there, that sort of thing. So then I had to take on, I was gunnery officer as well, and I had to take on navigator. He was sort of demoted, quite unofficially.
Was he? I mean, that could be unpleasant in the same wardroom as you. Did he blame you at all?
No. Oh no, we were very friendly. He was my wife's brother's term above me. He never bore me any ill will. He was axed after the war.
So you were going up to the Baltic via Copenhagen.
We spent a little time in Copenhagen to begin with.
And you have a story of a spy, you met.
Oh yes, we have had a lot of trouble with he was a, I suppose he was a Jew, really. At any rate, he was a Russian agent.
How did you know?
How did we know? Because he was always trying to get things out of the sailors. His mentee for coming on board was selling watches. You want to buy a watch? I got very good on, you know, gold watches and all that sort of thing. And then trying to have a look around the ship, ask the sailors questions and things like that, you see. So we soon mowed him out. And we took him out in a taxi.
We kidnapped him.
We took him. He was terrified. He thought we were going to shoot him. We got a hold of a taxi. We knew the driver. We told the police actually afterwards. I remember telling the policeman, and he said, "Yes, I know him well. I often deal with him." And he pulled up his sleeve like that, and he had gold watches all the way up his sleeve like that. He said, "I'd take them off him. He'd know on them." So he had some dealings with him. At any rate, we took him out, and we told the taxi driver to take him out into the wildest place he could find. And so we drove out into the country around Copenhagen. We came to what I would call a blasted heath. And we took his boots off and chucked him over the side, and he had to walk home. It was about 15 miles, I think. So that was that.
Now, where were you heading in the Baltic?
We worked our way up the Baltic. We were aiming to get up to a place called Bjorko, which is in Finland. Our object was to join up with the flotilla. We hardly knew any of the flotilla at all. You get so separated in wartime.
Do you know what number it was?
I think it was the 13th, but it became... I think they altered the number. It was the 13th. But we hardly ever saw them. We saw them surrender the German fleet and hardly saw them. You're always away on a job, like you go to Hamburg, all over the place. At any rate, we went up the Baltic. We called at a little port called Libau. Libau.
Now, there'd been some atrocities there, and then there was...
Yes, I wrote a story about that, which is true.
What exactly happened?
Well, the Germans, it was just beyond East Prussia, north of that. They had, towards the end of the war and after the war, just after the war, a Prussian army, not a regular army, but a Prussian army, advanced up to the coast. And they entered Libau, captured it, and then they lined all the women up, all between the ages, I think, of 15 and 40, I think, lined all the women up. If the women wouldn't try to resist, they either shot them or dragged them along. They showed us a rough shed at the top of the pier, and they lined the German soldiers up in one line and the women in another, and they went and raped all the women, two by two, took all their particulars, and they were visited subsequently to see if they're pregnant. And if they, or when they had a child, they were given, I think, a fortnight with the child, and then the child was removed, taken back to Germany, and joined what became Hitler's chaps, and they.
And this was a sort of mercenary, not mercenary, but a fry corps or something. It wasn't part of the German army, but it was almost a gang.
It was a gang. It was Prussian officers. What's organised? I mean, they had been regular soldiers, but we formed into this division because we met up with them again later on.
Were you sure this story wasn't just propaganda? I mean, because you know some of these stories are.
Oh no, because. The chap we made contact with when we got into this little harbour had been in America, and he talked very good English. He was a very good interpreter. And when he was talking to me, one of these wretched women walked past, sort of in rags and a shawl and that sort of thing, a very haggard face. And he pointed to her and said that was one of them. And I said, what happened to her? And he said, oh, she had two children during the time they were here. And I said, how old is she? And he said, oh, about 18. That's all. No, I think there's no question of it. The place had been absolutely ruined, and the houses were all burnt. He said they did resist to begin with, but they couldn't hold out. So that was that.
Later on, you came to bombard that.
Well, then we moved up, and we went to this place called Bjorko, which is in Finland, at the head of the Baltic, which is the nearest we could get to Kronstadt. Where the Russian fleet was. Well, our mission, like call that really another war, we were to assist our gallant allies, who are the Estonians. They are the top of the Baltic states, the one nearest to Russia. And they were fighting the Reds. They were commanded by a general, white Russian general, called Yudenvich, who had an army of white Russians and Estonians and oddments. We'd captured two destroyers from the Russians called the Wombola and the Lennox, and we turned them over to the Estonians, who manned them, under an admiral who had been captain of a town called Pitka. And he called himself an admiral, though he hadn't got enough gold lace to go all around his arm. Those forces. And we used to allow him 100 rounds of ammunition a month. And he was then we beat it as soon as we gave him that, because his idea of warfare was that he used to go to the nearest bay, nearest he gets the Russians, and fire off the whole of his 100 rounds in all directions. So we used to go to sea then. Well, we were supposed to assist them. The whole of that part of the country there were just one solid forest. I mean, trees everywhere. We never knew where their army was. And as far as that goes, the Reds. So,
did you have much time for your side? So you called them gallant allies, but were you being sarcastic?
Well, no, they were very nice chaps. They were very nice fellows. They came and asked us if we would help them, you see, bombard the enemy lines. They were advancing towards Petrograd. And they, or St. Petersburg, was it? They got quite near it too. At any rate, we said, It's no use asking us to bombard the enemy lines because the whole blicky thing was a forest. Didn't see anything. And until we have a map. And you show us where the positions are. And they said that was very difficult because there was only one map that they had. Well, the long and the short of it was that we said if they got hold of this map, we'd give them a bottle of whiskey. And they did. They got hold of the map, which showed the positions. So then we knew a bit more where we were, you see. And we used to... you couldn't tell whether you'd hit anything at all because the whole blinking thing was just trees, forest. Then we had difficulty because there was a third force. They called themselves the White Russians and the Estonians, and they were fighting the Reds. And then there were the green shirts, and they just fought anybody who they felt inclined to. Nobody knew. They merely called themselves Greens, and they'd have a scrap with anybody. So that altogether it was wasn't very easy.
What was it like in the port?
Well, in Bjorko, we were in Finland. Who, of course, were sort of neutral and that sort of thing. Navigation was one of my vast problems because most of the Russian charts, we got hold of some Russian charts, but they were anything up to 3 miles out. In Bjorko, for example, we anchored in the middle of what was supposed to be an island. There seemed plenty of water there, so we anchored there. It was very interesting that we used to lie in there, and every now and then we'd go out on patrol and do some bombarding. The Russians had a fort place called Krasnaya Gorka, just over the other side of the top end of the Baltic, with 12-inch guns. They used to have a crack at us occasionally, but they just couldn't reach where we were anchored. There was also a Russian aviator who we used to call Reckless Rupert, and he used to come over and was supposed to bomb us every now and then. According to locals, the Reds had got hold of his wife and his family, and they said that if he didn't go over and bomb us, well, that was the end of his wife and family. You see, they kept them. Well, he was terrified of getting shot down and things like that. We had one seaplane, which was about half the speed of his SPAD, but as soon as he saw our seaplane, he went for daylight, where he used to drop his bombs in the forest, like that. Then there was a village there. There was, what interested me, two things. One was, there was a little chalet. I imagine the Russians would call it a dacha, whatever they call it, where there was an old couple, and this chalet belonged to the Tsar, and his family used to spend part of the summer there. And this old couple looked after it. They were the caretakers, and there were the children's and the veranda, the children's toys and all that sort of thing. And they said, we wait for them to come back. They have not come. They didn't realize they'd been liquidated. And it was rather pathetic to see this old couple waiting. So what happened, I don't know, in the end. Those are the sort of incidents.
You got on well with the local, the Finns?
Yes. Oh, yes, they were quite friendly, yes. I was very interested because just near where we were anchored, they were building a caique, 200-ton caique. And we got quite friendly with them. All you have to do to build a thing like that in Finland in those days was that you go to the shore where there's a decent bit of water there, and there's forest everywhere. And you cut down a number of trees and you wait for them to get ready for using. and then you build your kike. And the only implements they had were adzes. And they could, well, I suppose they had a saw. The only other things other than wood that they used were a few long bolts and oakum for the oakum pitch. And we watched them build this thing. It's quite a big thing. They would get in the water somehow. I don't know how the hell they got in the water, but they'd get in the water, and they were very interesting. They could plane a plank with an adze, like you and I would plane it through the saw with a lathe. Extraordinary.
Now, one time you bombarded a German force.
Yes.
Was that after the Libau affair? Or?
That was after the Libau.
What was that? I mean,
well, they were advancing up.
Was it the same unit?
As far as we know, I wouldn't swear to that. But what we were told was that there was this force of 4,000 men, and they were advancing up the coast, and they were going to. They for some reason, don't ask me why, they were going to attack the Judenrich in the rear.
The who?
Judenrich, the Estonian general. the White Russians, in other words. And they were told that, this is merely what we were told, you see. At any rate, he was told that he was not to do that by our authorities, and that he must go back to Germany. Otherwise, we should stop him. And he's reported to have replied, "I will blow your little ships out of the water. Go to hell, you see." At any rate, we were told ourselves, and I think, I don't remember the name of our concert, but I think it probably was Walpole. We were told that we were to take action. They were advancing up the coast, right along the coast, easier, I suppose, going. And they were camped in a certain place. I don't think it had a name. It was mostly sand dunes, sandy place, sort of place like that. And they had a big camp there. And we were ordered, our orders were that we were to take retributive action 15 minutes of gunfire and destroy the camp. So we went in, the two of us, the rest of the flotilla and people were in the sport outside, further out. And we went into 500 yards, and there they all were, capped, field guns, a lot, tents, horses, all sorts of things. And we belted for 15 minutes non-stop. And I think they reckoned that we killed about 1,700. I mean, it's absolute hell on this earth. And that was it. And the rest of them never stopped until they got back to Germany.
Any other recollections of your time in the Baltic?
Only the young lady who used to bathe without any clothes on, just opposite us, where we anchored. I think I've written a story about in the book about Lelka.
Yeah, that was a true story.
Oh, yes, Lelka. I think she was a Pole. Her name was Krabowski, I think. But that is, you see, I don't know whether they still do it, but in those days, in the Baltic, they always were bathed without anything on. It was the normal practice. And it's pretty hot in the summer there, during the summer period. And she was doing nothing abnormal at all. A bit awkward when she decided to swim off to the ship. But that was just the lighter side of life.
And you were able to cope with your duties as navigation officer?
Yes.
Because you didn't actually have a watchkeeping certificate.
No.
They discovered. How had that happened? Because you should have had that, shouldn't
oh,
you?
Oh, yes, I should have.
Was that just an oversight that you hadn't been given it? Or?
Well, it started, you see, because I started keeping watch in the Relentless and the Paloo as a midshipman. And a midshipman wouldn't be entitled either to keep watch or at sea. And certainly not without a watch keeping certificate. And so I didn't bother about it until I imagined that my captain thought I had one. And it wasn't until Peplow said to me, "When did you get your watch keeping certificate?" that I really realised myself.
And could they just write you one, or was there a test?
Oh, you have to, they write you one, but I mean, you've got to keep watch under a regular officer watch until the captain is convinced that you are worthy of a watch keeping certificate.
And then after the Baltic, you went back to England to college?
That's it, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.